I'm glad that you're here to hear about practical apologetics. The last 2 years that I've been at the Life Preparation Conference, I've been speaking on apologetics, but it wasn't called practical apologetics the last 2 years, so that was impractical apologetics they had previously, and now this year we're going to get around to the practical apologetics. Now, actually, it's being called practical apologetics because Gary wanted me especially to emphasize answering specific, detailed problems and objections that are raised against the Christian faith. And I won't spend a lot of time, in the process I'll have to spend some time, but I won't spend a lot of time dealing with apologetical theory and procedure or, if you will, the abstract steps behind it. I'm going to try to take up problem after problem after problem and deal with it. And in the process, you should learn how to do apologetics by watching what's done. I want to really encourage you to not simply try to memorize the answers that Dr. Bonson or somebody else might have to a particular problem. It is helpful to get started by hearing somebody defend the faith and know what they say. But it's far more important that you learn the method. And so if you watch all of the different problems being dealt with, ask yourself, what is he doing here? What kinds of maneuvers is he using intellectually? What kind of reasoning is being applied to answer this problem? The reason why I want you to do that is, in the 10 hours, I guess that's what I'm going to be using this week, Lord willing, I can't possibly answer every particular problem, deal with every false religion out there, every cult and so forth. It's just not possible. There's really two different ways to approach apologetics. I want you to think of yourself as being in a room with a man that has a revolver. You have no weapon to use against him. Okay? And he's got all these bullets in his gun, and he's getting ready to shoot you. And there's no exit. Now, as I see it, there are two things you can do. Or if you knew you were going to be put into this room, there are two ways you could prepare. One way to prepare to deal with all of those bullets that are going to be shot at you is to practice dodging bullets. Really work on all the maneuvers, up and down and so forth. And so you say, I hope that even though this guy's got 6 or 8 bullets in his gun, that I can just jump around and miss. He just won't hit me any of those times. Or another way would be to practice disarming your opponent so that he is not able to shoot anymore. Now, of those two, which do you think would be the more practical way to approach apologetics? If we have any bullet dodgers out there in the audience, this week's going to disappoint you. Though I'm going to be dodging some bullets, dealing with specific arguments, what I want you to learn is how to get the gun out of the other guy's hand. I want you to disarm your opponent. And the method of apologetics that I teach, often called in academic circles presuppositional apologetics, is especially designed to do that. To go after the presuppositions by which the opponent of Christianity is able to shoot those bullets at you. And you're going to take away his ability to do that. Okay, so we're going to be looking at specific arguments. Now, toward the end of my second lecture hour this afternoon, we're either going to pass out some cards to you or ask you to donate your own paper to the cause. And I would like you to be thinking right now, or throughout my lecture, what is the toughest, or for some of you maybe two toughest arguments you've run into against your Christian faith? I want you to write those down and turn them in so that over the next few days I can organize them and look at them myself and make sure, if at all possible, that's going to be my goal, to in one way or another address every one of those in the process of doing my lectures. I would like you to know that the particular problem that you've heard does have an answer. And I think we should be able to accomplish that. It all depends on how wide, how varied the problems are. So be thinking about that. I'd like to hear your specific and detailed, and the toughest thing you've heard, or maybe you honestly don't know yourself. You say, well, what do I say when somebody says if God is all good and all powerful, he should be able to and willing to stop the wars that are in the world. But since there is war, he's either not all good or he's not all powerful. And we call that the problem of evil. You don't have to know the name of the problem. But if you've heard somebody say that, or if just in your own heart you thought to yourself, I don't know about it. How can Christianity be true given, and then whatever it is, You write that down. You do not have to put your names on there. If you wish to put your name on there, then I'll know who to speak to about it if you want to come up and talk more and so forth. But you give me those, and I'll try to address them. So let's get started. How do we answer objections to the Christian faith? When I was getting ready to come to the conference, I left from Orange County to fly here. I had to fly through Chicago, which is interesting routing, go to Chicago so you can get to Atlanta. But nevertheless, the flight was delayed for a few minutes. And if you know anything about people who fly a lot, they get very nervous. And so the stewardess got on the line and was telling everybody, don't worry, we're delayed here at the gate because we have to finish up some paperwork for the mechanics that are down below. I've always thought, if you tell people mechanics are looking at this plane and we're going to have to wait a few minutes to get you in the air, maybe that would worry them all the more. You know, I mean, mechanics are fixing something? I sure hope they fix it right. Well, as a matter of fact, there are just standard things, whether the plane's in good or bad condition, that they have to go through and they have to check off to make sure that they have flight clearance and they can back away from the gate and go on out and the tower will let them take off. So what I would like to do is something similar. I'm going to give you a checklist of things to be looking for when someone argues against the Christian faith so you can figure out whether their argument flies or not. Will this thing, you know, really, you know, get into the air and be able to sustain itself or not? And you want to go through in your mind mentally this checklist. I suppose you could write it all down very small on a card and pull it out every time somebody's arguing with you and say, okay, now, what about this? Maybe for the first few times you will do that, I don't know, but that's not what I have in mind. I would like to tell you what the checklist is so you have some idea, internalize this, so you can use it. When you're sitting at the university and you hear a professor say things that are contrary to the Christian faith, start asking these questions. And I tried to boil it down to just four, although there are going to be some subdivisions underneath that. But if you can remember these four issues, I guarantee you, you will be able to deal with any argument that comes up. I don't care what bullets they put in their gun, you're going to be able to take the gun away. Okay, so let me put them on the board for you and then talk about them. The four things that we're talking about here amount to the key intellectual sins that all men commit. Sadly, Christians commit these sins too. We're not here to talk about renovating the mind and sanctification of our thinking process as Christians so much this week. We're going to be looking at the foibles and defects of unbelieving thinking. But I want you to know that what I'm talking about, though it's being applied to apologetics, really has application through all of the different departments of the university as well. Any person who is an academician must worry about these issues when he publishes something, when he puts an article out there, when he gives a lecture, whatever it may be. Every argument can be evaluated in terms of these things. First of all, you want to ask, is he being arbitrary? And I'm going to have, according to my notes, four subdivisions here of different kinds of arbitrariness. But let me get through the main divisions first. Ask, is this argument arbitrary? Secondly, ask whether this argument is inconsistent. That is there something wrong with this argument because it's in conflict with itself or with some other known truth? Thirdly, ask about the consequences of this argument. This is what is known in the Bible as judging a tree by its fruit. Look at the consequences of the argument. And then finally, it's hard to put this into one word, and I promise I'll explain it later, but for brevity, I'm going to call it asking about the preconditions of this argument. I think some of you know that part of the ministry the Lord has given me and has been very gracious to me about is public debate. And when I go to a debate, although I try to read what my opponent has written and know something in advance, it is far more important to me to know how to argue with people. So you know, whatever kind of thing the opponent comes up with, I'll be able to deal with. It's far more important to master the technique than the specific things that he has written previously. And the four things that I'm always asking myself, although I do it a little bit differently, I think this will be easier for you, is I ask about, is this arbitrary? Is this inconsistent? What are the consequences? And does he have the preconditions of intelligibility to argue this way? All right? Anybody have any problems so far? You understand minimally what we're talking about? Four areas of examination. Let's begin with number one. I'll try to explain it in more detail. How are people arbitrary in the way that they argue? The most obvious way is they offer a mere opinion. A number of years ago when I started teaching apologetics, I would not have stopped to deal with this. The idea that people offer just mere opinions. But now that I've got a lot more practice and I've been out there and I've heard from people what they run into when they try to defend the faith, I realize I've got to say something about this. In fact, at this conference, I've had this happen in the past. Just about everywhere I go and put on apologetics conferences, I can offer people pretty powerful arguments, you know, against unbelievers. And I think pretty strong arguments in favor of Christianity. However, almost always there's somebody in the audience who says, well, but then what if somebody says, yes, but my opinion is the following? I say, yeah, okay, well, then you can refute that. And then they say, yes, but it's my opinion. I say, yeah, but you've refuted it. They say, but then my friend says, well, you believe one way, and it's my opinion, this. Then finally kind of hit me in terms of my academic, theoretical approach to apologetics. Out there in the street, this is one of the most common ways to oppose Christianity. People say, well, yeah, you believe that, but I don't. Okay, so I'm going to stop and cover what I would have thought was really obvious previously, but since apparently it's not obvious, we'll talk about it for a few minutes. One of the key, and probably the key intellectual sin committed by people is arbitrariness. The very reason why you go to school, allegedly, modern colleges don't teach critical thinking very well, they're not too interested in it anymore, but it used to be the case that the reason you went to school is to learn to reason, to think, to have some facts, to make educated, as we say, educated judgments about things, and not just be flying off the handle with, well, I believe this, and other people believe that, and that's all there is to it. People who are educated are supposed to have principles by which they test theories. They're supposed to have a manner of reasoning that will allow them to draw a conclusion without just, you know, saying, well, I feel this way, I feel that. I got to thinking about this. Why is it that Christians don't jump on that when unbelievers do that? Because the minute an unbeliever says, well, you've got all those arguments, but my opinion is this, I mean, they have conceded the case. They've lost. That's it. It's all over. If I was doing a debate, I'd take the microphone and say, speak up for the audience. Tell them this is simply your opinion. Because your opinion has just been sliced and diced. It doesn't make any difference if it's your opinion. It's wrong. But it's my opinion. I thought to myself, why do Christians put up with that? Why do they think, oh, what am I going to do now? How do I twist his arm even more so he'll cry uncle? And then I think I've come up with the answer, or at least a good part of the answer, and that's because so often when Christians go to Bible studies, that's the kind of garbage they hear too. You go to Bible studies and you'll read a passage and then everybody kind of shares their opinion. Well, I want to think of God this way. I want to think of God that way. Well, you know what? God doesn't care what you think. I mean, he's not affected by what you think. He cares in the sense that ultimately you'll answer to his word for what you think. But nevertheless, often enough Christians, even when it comes to the most authoritative word people can have, they still think we have the right to center and go, well, but my opinion is this and somebody else's opinion is that. You see this all the time when we talk about the sovereignty of God. If I do a Bible study or preach a sermon on the sovereignty of God and people don't like the idea that God predestines every detail in advance, that's what the Bible says, even to the hairs of our head. But I'll have people tell me. They'll say, but I don't want to think of God as being like that. Big deal. You don't want to think of God being like that. Well, now, what if This last year I had something happen to me which I considered fairly tragic. I was very unhappy about it. It was a real test to my sanctification. I was diagnosed as having diabetes. Now, I already have heart problems. I've already had emergency open stomach surgery to save my life. And so it's tough enough, I think. You know, it's one of those times where you're wondering if you don't want to say, God, isn't this enough, thank you? But God decided that it was for my best, and I'm sure it is. But at the time, it was very hard. And when the doctor told me, Greg, I'm sorry, but the tests indicate you have diabetes, I argued with him nicely and politely. In fact, I had enough questions for him. He finally said, Greg, you have to understand, I'm a doctor. Trust me. And I told him, I'm a doctor too, and it's my job to ask questions. I want to know more about this. But now, I didn't want to have diabetes. I don't want to have it now. It's not fun. But if I were to say, I don't want to think of myself as having diabetes, is that going to change anything? Why is it when it comes to something medical, we all realize, well, you'd be a fool. What if I were to say, no, I'm not going to take my medicine because I don't want to think of myself as somebody that's a diabetic. I don't want to miss all those sweet desserts and especially drinking the real thing, Coke and so forth. I'm getting so tired of iced tea. I'm telling you, I don't want to be like that anymore. So in my opinion, I don't have diabetes. That'd be preposterous. And yet when it comes to things that are far more important than our own personal health, things having to do with our eternal well-being, you still have people out there who will tell you, well, I don't want to think of God being that way. Or my God is not like that. Or if I were running the universe, I wouldn't. But you're not running the universe, and you're not God, and your opinion is really irrelevant. Please understand that I'm not telling you how to speak to the unbeliever. There may be a place for being sarcastic and saying, well, big deal, that's your opinion. But usually you want to be more polite and so forth. But you need to know that when someone says it's my opinion, that has no weight intellectually. Opinions are a dime a dozen. Actually, it's not even a dime a dozen. It doesn't cost anything, and it isn't worth anything. If someone wishes to assert that such and such is true, they need to do more than say, I believe it. Because the intellectual question that is asked in every department of the university, not just in philosophy departments, is, well, why? Why do you believe that quinine relieves malaria? Why do you believe that Napoleon was mentally unfit? Why? What's your evidence? What's your proof? Until somebody is going to go beyond mere opinion and offer an argument, some line of proof or evidence for their views, they haven't got anything worth hearing. A second form of arbitrariness that you should be looking for is similar to this mere opinion, and that is relativism. Somebody says, well, it's not my opinion that there is a God. It's not my opinion that God is like that, so forth and so on. That has no cash value at all. The cash value of the relativist is the relativist says, well, you're convinced by that. I'm convinced by other things. And so it's different strokes for different folks, as I like to say. Good 60s expression. You know? You like to think this way, I like to think that way, and you probably have very good reasons for believing that. You know, the relativist can deal with the Christian apologist who is kind of naive very easily by saying, oh, I've heard all your arguments, and you know, that's pretty impressive. But that's true for you, it's not true for me. I'm curious, have you ever heard people say things like that? It's kind of like, well, we all create our own reality, you know? Recently, when I was in Moscow, I went to an international conference on religious liberty, which in itself is very significant, I think, that in Russia, they're having a conference on religious liberty, and they held it, I think, probably purposely, to be ironic and maybe a bit pointed, they held it in the former building that was for the Communist Youth Brigade, where people were taught, you know, atheistic communism. Now in Russia, we have religious liberty. But of course, as you might realize, religious liberty means different things. And they probably didn't realize what they were getting into when they invited me to speak to them on that subject. Because for 2 days, I had to endure all this barfy stuff about how you know, religion is the realm of the mysterious, and we're all doing our best, you know, and we're all very sincere, and we're all, you know, really brothers under the skin, and we really love each other, and we respect each other. And poor Dr. Bonson stood up and said, well, no, as a matter of fact, we don't all respect each other, and we aren't all brothers. Okay. Basically, the argument for religious liberty that I was hearing from Muslims and Hindus and Roman Catholics and Lutherans and Seventh-day Adventists and Russian Orthodox and old believers and so forth, the argument I was hearing is known as relativism. No one knows for sure, and so you create your own reality. You know, you've got to live with your own understanding of God. You've got to make your way in this world, and if your view of God helps you feel better, then that's true for you. But then there are other traditions which should be equally respected in Russia, now that we're opening the door to religion. That's what they're arguing. Other traditions that have to be respected as well. Okay, so when I spoke, I'm not going to give you that whole lecture. Let me boil it down. I basically said religious liberty cannot be founded on relativism. See, they thought relativism was just another way of talking about religious liberty. Everybody has a right to their own opinion. I said, if you believe that everyone creates their own reality, then Hitler creates his own reality too. And Hitler, therefore, in terms of his reality, has the right to kill the Jews. Because that's the reality he's created. And so here you have a suppression of religious liberty, in fact, genocide, and relativism condones it. Because after all, everybody creates their own reality. And then I went through an ugly laundry list of all of the persecution each of the groups in the audience, including Protestants, American Protestants, were guilty of in terms of religious liberty. I said, every one of us is guilty, if we're a relativist, of persecuting other people and allowing for it and holding to views that would allow for that. When someone tells you, you create your own reality and everybody's right, the answer is, if everybody's right, then clearly nobody's wrong, including the Idi Amins of the world, the Hitlers, the David Koreshes, and all the rest. Relativism kills itself. It isn't sufficient for somebody to say, well, you believe that, but I believe something else, and in a reality just kind of twist and turn to fit everybody. It's like reality becomes a smorgasbord. You go into the smorgasbord, maybe you'll choose the eggplant. I sure wouldn't. But I'll choose the fried chicken, and you don't particularly want fried chicken. But reality will be whatever you want. You have the eggplant approach to reality, you have the chicken approach to reality. Pick whatever you want. It's not like that. And certainly God is not like that. God is not a smorgasbord. God doesn't say, well, just please let me into your life. I'll be whatever you want me to be. And that's what I call the Mr. Potato Head approach to theology. You know, some people will put Mr. Potato Head together with eyes here and ears over here and all the rest. Other people say, no, God's not like that. He's really like this. And it was not going to be adequate to say, well, God is whatever you want him to be. What an insult! If God is whatever you want him to be, he is not God. Or she is not God. It is not God. Relativist says, well, it's true for you, it's not true for me. True for you is one of the most asinine statements in the English language. Truth is not person relative. You know, let's go back to the doctor's office. Dr. Bonson is told by this doctor, he's supposed to know, he has the blood work, he has the lab tests and so forth. He says, Dr. Bonson, you've got diabetes. I say, well, that's true for you. That's not true for me. No. The relativist says, nobody can know anything for sure. And this is what you're going to get. I guarantee you, if you go to a secular school and the teacher likes you, and interestingly enough, in many cases, teachers do like Christians, even though they're not Christians. You know why? Because the Christian students are the few students that will challenge them and seem to be alert. At least they'll talk intelligently. And I'm not saying that as gratuitous, you know, flattery to you guys because you're Christians. I mean that. I've seen that over and over again. Teachers will say, please come around and talk about this more. At least you're thinking. These other kids, you know, just want to party or just want to get through the class, whatever. But if the teacher talks to you after class, wants to hear more, and then wants to, you know, it's always this condescending, let me help you out of your Sunday school superstition and ignorance, you know. The university is going to really mature you. This is going to be the age of enlightenment for you, let me tell you. Well, after you hold to your faith and you give answers to the objections and so forth, you'll often have the teacher tell you, and then you have roommates and others who will say this in a less sophisticated way. The teacher will say, well, you have to understand that, you know, truth is relative. And you're very committed to this, but in the university you're going to learn there are other truths, there are other universes to explore. Oh, barf. Other universes? I'd like to live in the one where I find myself, thank you. I want to deal with this one. When someone tells you that truth is relative, that there is no absolute truth, the question you're going to have is that absolutely true? Let me say that again, because some of you started to nod off. Now, I'm going to begin the sentence, and when I get to the end, I want to see all of you still looking up here, okay? When someone says there is no absolute truth, you're going to say, is that absolutely true? Now we're on the horns of a dilemma, as logicians put it. Because if the teacher says, nope, even that's not absolutely true, you say, well, then fine, then I'm free to believe otherwise, and there is absolute truth. If the teacher says, oh, well, I don't want to do that, so... yeah, it's absolutely true. You say, well, then you're wrong that there is no absolute truth, because it's absolutely true that there is no absolute truth. And by the way, if it's absolutely true that there is no absolute truth, you've contradicted yourself, and so maybe you ought to go back and get some more education before you teach this class. Don't say that. Relativism is just another form of being arbitrary. Educated people know better than to be arbitrary. There are not many educated people in our culture today. Most college graduates are not educated people. I do not mean that to be just a slur and a slam against college graduates, but it's true. Literally, descriptively true. People can get a piece of paper from college and not know how to think, not know how to research, not how to put together one paragraph of a decent argument. And the reason, well... it's among many reasons, but a major reason why people don't think anymore is because we've gotten used to being arbitrary, offering mere opinions, and then when there's a clash between the mere opinions, running to relativism. Because isn't that a lot more comfortable? If you're a relativist, then you can go to cocktail parties and everybody's welcome. I've done this. I go to parties when I was at SC in the graduate school and so forth. Jesus would be welcome at their cocktail parties. As long as Jesus didn't say he was the only truth, that'd be fine. Then we have Buddha, and we have Jesus, and we have Confucius, and we have Mao, and all the rest. And everybody's just having a good time. If we respect each other, then we don't have to worry about people getting down on us. I'm welcome, you're welcome. Hey, I'm okay, you're okay. It's relativism. And it's academically shoddy. People who contradict each other cannot both be right. In some cases, depending on the nature of the contradiction, both can be wrong, but both cannot be right. I cannot have diabetes and it not be the case that I have diabetes at the same time. Now, for the rest of this week, I'm going to talk about other problems, but I dare say that the other problems I'll be talking about will only be 20% of what's out there. I realize we've only spent a few minutes together. But in all honesty, what you're going to run into over and over and over again are these two problems. Mere opinion and relativism. Mere opinion and relativism. So get used to that and tell people if that's only your opinion, it's academically worthless. If it's only your opinion that God doesn't exist, then you're in real trouble. Or if you say, well, it's true for you, but it's not true for me. Point out, that doesn't even make sense, true for you. True for you is actually a paraphrase of the verb to believe. When someone believes something, that is simply to say they think it's true. So when someone says, it's true for me, they're saying, I believe it. Yeah, every year we get into this. Gary was a student of mine, and he's getting even with me. He puts up these signs and says, there's no way that's right. Redo your clock, okay? You say there's only 15 minutes left? Well, that's true for you. It's not true for me. Oh, we're going to negotiate now. What is that? Looks like only 15 minutes. That's right, Gary. Another form, I haven't left myself enough room. Another form of arbitrariness is ignorant conjecture. Many times people will argue against the Christian faith, and they'll offer what they think are pretty intelligent considerations against it. But when you ask, what is the foundation for their making those claims, you find out they don't have any research, they don't have any evidence behind it. It's just pure conjecture. Let me give you an example. For a lot of people, it seems that since the Bible was written so many hundreds of years ago, it's just very likely that you cannot trust the text of the Bible that we have in our hands today. I have a Bible here today published. Well, I'm not sure when it was printed, but this is the 1901 edition of the revised version of the Bible. Now, if the Bible was supposed to have been written in the first century, and this one was published at the beginning of the 20th century, then obviously there are hundreds of years between the first manuscript and it being copied and then translated and translations being copied and so forth until we finally get to the 20th century and we have this particular Bible that's here. And many unbelievers will simply take it for granted that the Bible you have in your hands cannot be true to the original text. Surely, they'll say, scribes have altered, scribes have supplemented the original text of the Bible. We can't be sure what Moses really wrote, or Jeremiah, or John, or Paul. In fact, we can't even be sure that those were the authors of those books, much less, if they were, what they actually said originally. For all we know, I've actually had unbelievers, I've had people who have PhDs say this to me. It is so preposterous. But they'll say, for all we know, some monk in the Dark Ages penned those lines. And then they got picked up by the next scribe, and gets carried down to the 20th century. We don't really know what the original author said. And that kind of ignorant criticism will seem intellectually sophisticated to some unbelievers. They'll think, well, in our natural human experience, messages that are passed from one speaker to another get garbled, they get distorted, don't they? Wouldn't you expect that would be true then of this book as well? You all know what I'm talking about? If you don't, you should live in my house for a while. When phone messages come to my children, the way they get to me often doesn't look a whole lot like the way they began. Messages get garbled. And now, if that happens when there's two or three people in between the speaker and the recipient of the message, how much more would it be if there are hundreds or thousands of people? It just seems to unbelievers, you've all played telephone, right? Isn't that what it's called? You start, you know, around the circle with a message, and one person whispers to the next. By the time it gets around, it doesn't look anything like the original. And so unbelievers will say, obviously, we don't even know what the text of the Bible is. Any number of people could have added or taken away or distorted what was originally there. Now, when unbelievers say something like that, you must point out that their argument rests upon ignorant conjecture. It may seem likely that the biblical text would no longer be reliable, would no longer be authentic after all these years, but that likelihood is an evaluation based not on evidence, but upon prejudice. And let me point out a couple of the prejudices. First of all, there's the prejudice, the assumption that the biblical text is no different from any other written document which we find in our natural human experience. Please pay attention to that. Because one of the easiest ways unbelievers, and especially unbelieving professors, suck Christians into their way of thinking is by saying, well, now, wait a minute, you can't just assume that this Bible has a supernatural origin, supernatural preservation. We've got to approach this book like any other book. But at that point, whether the assumption is stated or just taken for granted, you need to say, but it's not like any other book. It won't do any good to use the rules that apply to just any other book when this is an extraordinary book. Of course, the unbeliever is going to tell you, well, then you're begging the question because you're taking it for granted that this is an extraordinary book, and I'm trying to show you that it's not an extraordinary book. We'll say, I guess that's the nature of the debate, right? I approach it assuming as my ultimate authority that it is an extraordinary book, And we're going to see what happens when you deny that later on when we look at other things. And you take it for granted that it's not. But the point is, when an unbeliever says, if this happens when you play telephone, then it's got to happen when you write the Bible too. And you say, hey, you're comparing apples and oranges. Because a God has overseen the process of copying and translating. And this God has promised that His Word will not pass away. And therefore, I believe with all my heart that I have a copy of what God wants me to know. And that though there may be some variations between different textual lines, in any line of text, the basic message that God wants me to have is here, because He has promised so. Now, there's a second kind of prejudice, though, you need to see in this. And this prejudice is perhaps more obvious, because the unbeliever who says, you don't really know what the Bible originally said, hasn't offered any concrete evidence that some medieval monk tampered with the text before us today. When I had this person in the university who has a PhD tell me, I mean, throw it out kind of like a throwaway argument, like, well, for all you know, some monk wrote these words, and it got carried down to us. I simply said, I'd like to know what the literary evidence is for the idea that some monk added this to the Gospel of John. Oh, well, I don't have any. It's just that it's a possibility. In other words, I'm supposed to be refuted by a possibility? You think that would work in any other department of the university? I mean, if it does work, what a sore university that would be. A historian is refuted by the possibility that there's evidence against your thesis. You're not refuted by possibilities or conjectures, especially ignorant conjectures. That is very arbitrary to advance the hypothesis. And it doesn't have any evidential credentials. If you want to play that way, if you want to be arbitrary, I could say with equal arbitrariness, well, actually, the words that have come down to us as Paul's were written not after Paul wrote them, but before Paul wrote them. Now, I don't happen to believe that, but you see, if you're going to play the arbitrary game, you can go any way you want. And you say, well, maybe this was written by Isaiah, and then Paul found the manuscript and put his name on it. Now, you know, the opponent would not respect it. He'd say, oh, you're just playing games. I'm saying, wait a minute. I learned this game from you. You're the one who said maybe some medieval monk added these words, but you don't have any evidence that a medieval monk added these words. So if we don't need evidence, why don't we all make up our own reality? The third indication of prejudice is that when an unbeliever says something like that about the text of the Bible, it shows they haven't read about the subject. If the critic had taken time to look up the subject of textual criticism, he or she would not have offered the outlandish conjecture that maybe a medieval monk or somebody else along the line added these lines to the Bible. That came home to me very clearly, again, when I was in graduate school. I took my PhD in philosophy, and one of the areas of my specialization, that's what it says on the paper anyway, is ancient philosophy. And so we had to do detailed study of Plato and Aristotle and others you would not have heard of. You have heard of Plato and Aristotle, though, right? Okay, good. And part of what we did when we studied Plato was textual criticism of Plato. Let me explain. We have a corpus of writings that you can go into any university bookstore today, and you can probably buy the collected works of Plato. And this body of writings is attributed to Plato. But as you know, the book that you buy in the bookstore was not handwritten by Plato. You did know that. Assure me that you knew that, okay? Somebody copied another copy of Plato, and that came from another copy on down, right? Now then, somebody could ask the question, did Plato actually write this particular line in the Republic? Is this paragraph his? You say, well, let's go back to the original. Oh, problem is, we don't have the originals of Plato. We only have copies. And we do our best to construct what Plato actually said from the copies that are at hand. Now, our earliest extant manuscript of a work by Plato dates right before 900 AD. It's the Oxford B manuscript. It was found in a Patmos monastery by E.B. Clark. It was a wondrous find in terms of Plato scholarship and so forth. But what I want you to see is this manuscript dates, even according to unbelievers, back to Plato, but the earliest we can go back, is 900 years after Christ. Now, Plato flourished 350 years before Christ. So let's see if we can do our elementary math. 300 B.C. or 350 B.C., roughly, Plato is writing things, or so we believe, and these things are copied and copied and copied and copied and copied and copied, and finally a copy that was made about 900 A.D. is made. All the others, at this point anyway, have not been found. The earliest extant manuscript of Plato dates from 900 A.D. Now, what's the span between 350 B.C. and 900 A.D.? Over 12 centuries, right? Now, my philosophy professor and professors and others as well will hardly blink an eye about the reliability of the text of Plato that we have. They will occasionally raise a question here and there, but it's taken for granted. Of course we know what Plato wrote. And yet the very same people, or the students who are taught by the very same people, will ask this ignorant question about the Bible. Was it written? I mean, is the text we have before us, is it original? The gap between the earliest manuscripts of the New Testament that we have and the date of their writing is about 50 years. I'm going to use round numbers just to keep this simple. Anybody see what I'm getting at? The unbeliever who says, out of ignorant conjecture, well, I don't think you can trust the text of the New Testament, just doesn't know what he's talking about. Anybody who studied the subject knows that the Bible is the best attested manuscript from ancient history. Unbelievers will tell you that. That doesn't mean that they believe the Bible. That doesn't even mean that they're going to trust what it says. But they know that we're on far better ground in saying what Paul actually taught than what Plato actually taught. The text of the New Testament is remarkably uniform and well-established. The reliability of the Old Testament text was demonstrated by the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, now 40 years ago. In fact, the overall authenticity and accuracy of the biblical text is so well known that Frederick Kenyon once said, and I quote, "The Christian can take the whole Bible in his hand and say without fear or hesitation that he holds in it the true Word of God handed down without essential loss from generation to generation throughout the centuries." Such assessments from competent scholars could be multiplied rather easily. But the fact is, you're going to run into people who say, well, the Bible's like any other book. Probably some medieval monk added things or took things away. We stand on very good ground when we say the text that we have in our hands reflects the original that was given hundreds of years ago. Now, all I'm getting at here, and we're going to take a brief break, is that when unbelievers throw opinions at you, you must be willing to ask whether that's conjecture or whether there's evidence for that. If somebody says, well, I would imagine the text has been changed, you say, well, your imagination doesn't have any authority. I'd like to know if you have any evidence that the text has been changed. And when we get done with a brief break, I'll give you another example. There's actually people who say, we don't even know if Jesus ever lived. And that, too, is a case of ignorant conjecture. Another way in which we see ignorant conjecture being ye believers in the place of research and evidence and argument is in the radical opinion that we have no literary or historical basis for believing that Jesus of Nazareth actually ever lived. And you will hear people say that. You may hear, again, professors say that. And when they do, you need to spot the obvious prejudice and conjecture in that kind of remark. You see, such a criticism simply takes it for granted that the Bible should not be taken in any way as a literary source of historical information. Somebody says, we have no literary evidence for the existence of Jesus. You've got to hold up your Bible and say, well, there's quite a bit in here. Oh, well, but that doesn't count. Oh, why not? Now again, just meeting the unbeliever on his own turf for the time being, which is not the most important way of doing apologetics, as you'll see. But the point is, unbelievers should be embarrassed by their intellectual prejudices. And you can point that out. Just about any unbelieving historian of the ancient world will have to admit that the Bible is a source of information about the ancient world. Now, that doesn't mean that they're willing to accept all that the Bible says or the way in which the Bible puts things. In fact, when you're studying, you sometimes will run into at secular universities courses on Christianity as a religion or the Bible as literature and so forth. And undoubtedly, you're going to run into an interpretation of the Bible that says something like this. Well, in the Old Testament, we read predictions of the Babylonian captivity. But, of course, we know that predictive prophecy is impossible. So these portions of the Old Testament were really written during the captivity or after the captivity in Babylon. You know, and people who are willing to be negative toward the Bible will float right downstream with that reasoning and say, oh, yeah, that's right. Can you see the prejudice that's involved in that? If the Bible is what it claims to be, then it's predictive prophecy. But if you say predictive prophecy is impossible, then you must know an awful lot. You must know that God does not exist, He is not personal, does not reveal Himself, and doesn't bother to give prophecies like that. And if you if you know all of that, it's not just your mere opinion. If you know all of that, then of course you can interpret the Old Testament and say, well, this must be written afterwards. So I'm not claiming that that unbelieving scholars who read the Bible are willing to accept every bit of it. But even those who say stupid things like there's no predictive prophecy and therefore this had to be written later, even those professors tell us that the Bible is a main source of information about the ancient Near East. And so when someone says we don't have any evidence, they're totally throwing the Bible out. They're not treating it like they treat other literature, which of course they say is their approach to things.